or give to WBAI.org.
But do it now, won't you? And do it with a credit card, because it's too late for you to mail in your pledges. And thanks for keeping us alive here at WBAI New York.
Good morning. It's 7 a.m. and 52 degrees in Central Park. We'll see a high near 68, and it will be mostly sunny this Wednesday, April 7th, 2021. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, free speech radio, WBAI New York. Coming up next, a new day. Continue a conversation about the state of the U.S. and global economies, which we started last week with Michael Roberts. Michael Roberts is a British economist and author of several books, including The Great Recession, A Marxist View, The Long Depression, and World in Crisis, A Global Analysis of Marxist Law of Profitability. He also writes regular commentary and analysis on his blog, The Michael Roberts Blog. Stay tuned for headlines. And this is your update on the COVID-19 pandemic. On April 6th, the Washington Post reported that Florida expanded eligibility for COVID-19 vaccines to all residents 16 and older. But across the state, more than 70,000 people still don't have access to the vaccine. Those men and women are Florida's state prisoners. More than half the country has opened up vaccine eligibility, vastly expanding the ability of most Americans to get the shots. whatever their age or medical conditions. But inside prisons, it's a different story. Prisoners not free to seek out vaccines for themselves still lack access on the whole. This is Desmond Mead, president of the Flora Rights Restoration Coalition, followed by Deputy Director Neil Voltz.
See this being rolled out in federal prisons. We see this being rolled out across other states. There have been more than twice the amount of people who have died from COVID-19 in Florida prisons and jails than the entire amount of people that's been executed by the state of Florida since 1976.
Let's be frank. This isn't an issue in which we can't do something. It's an issue in which we're choosing not to do something. And we believe that we can do better. This is about public health, in addition to answering that fundamental question about who we are and how we view each other.
Nationwide, less than 20% of state and federal prisoners have been vaccinated, according to data collected by the Marshall Project and the Associated Press. In some states, prisoners and advocates have resorted to lawsuits to get access. And even when they are eligible, they aren't receiving important education about the vaccine. And it's not just the prisoners. Public health experts widely agree that people who live and work in correctional facilities face an increased risk of contracting and dying from the coronavirus. Since the pandemic first reached prisons in March 2020, about 3 in 10 prisoners have tested positive and 2,500 have died. Prisons are often crowded with limited access to health care and protective gear, and populations inside are more likely to have pre-existing medical conditions. And a new day continues to follow the hunger strike by undocumented people in New York in protest of their exclusion from COVID-related financial assistance. Yesterday, April 6th, marked the 22nd day of their indefinite hunger strike. The group of strikers, which includes undocumented and recently incarcerated workers, are considered ineligible for unemployment benefits by the New York State. In some cases, the workers were also disqualified from receiving stimulus payments issued with the passage of the American Rescue Plan of 2021. In addition to stimulus checks, the federal bill provides physical recovery funds for state and local governments, fiscal recovery funds for state and local governments, unemployment compensation, homeowner and rent assistance, and tax credit to individuals and small businesses. The hunger strike was organized by the Fund Excluded Workers Coalition, which is comprised of more than 100 activist organizations from across New York City, including Make the Road New York. The coalition demanded that the New York State government allocate $3.5 billion to unemployment benefits for undocumented and recently incarcerated workers. So far, the government has committed to allocating $2.1 billion in funding. According to a report authored by the Fiscal Policy Institute, a New York-based public policy research organization, 173,000 previously excluded workers would benefit from the funding in New York City alone, alongside over 100,000 other workers throughout the rest of the state. During the day, strikers, organizers, and volunteers and their supporters typically assemble at the Judson Memorial Church, which lies across the street from the Kimmel Center for University Life, that's at NYU, and at an adjacent tent on LaGuardia Place, where they interact with passersby and host speakers and musical performances.
Today we should have been celebrating. Today we should have been serving them a meal. But instead, we're still waiting for an answer from Governor Cuomo. from Andrea Stewart Cousins and Carl Hasty.
I'm hoping that the governor will put his hand on his heart and realize what is happening here, that people are going on a hunger strike because they're so desperate for relief. It's been a year. Enough already.
There is plenty of money, but there isn't a political courage to do the right thing.
And moving on to other news, the St. Louis City Jail has been the site of prisoner uprisings in recent months. On Monday, April 5th, after a second night of uprising, prisoners broke windows, set a fire, and threw chairs out the second floor window. Third floor windows were destroyed. Black charring from the fires lined the areas surrounding the building. The sidewalk below was dotted with splatter marks from unknown debris. And orange jail shirts dangled from a ledge. About 50 to 75 supporters on the sidewalk below were protesting what they called inhumane conditions at the jail. Just before 11 p.m. Monday night, cheers erupted from the spectators downstairs as broken glass indicated a second incident, this time in the southwest corner of the third floor. The prisoners also lowered a rope made of bedsheets that had been tied together, but no one risked a climb down that rope. A February report by the Corrections Task Force, formed after another riot in February, called for an independent oversight board and said prisoners were most upset about being locked in their jail cells for most of the day, isolation from family, a perceived lack of COVID-19 precautions, the length of time they've been held awaiting trial, and lack of adequate medical care. This is Alderman and St. Louis mayoral candidate Kara Spencer.
We do need to come in and rectify this immediately. Look, this is a breakdown in trust in the general public, and I am fully committed to launching an investigation, a full-fledged investigation into all of the issues related to the health and well-being of those in our custody, as well as our employees.
And yesterday, I came across a moving story on mental health in an unlikely place, and I thought I'd share it with all of you. It's a brief interview conducted by hip-hop artist Talib Kweli and hip-hop artist Pharoah Monch. Take a listen.
I gotta give you props because there's a conversation around mental health that's getting better in Black communities, but a while ago, you did the PTSD album, and you spoke openly and honestly about your bouts with depression and mental health. Why do you feel like it's important that people, especially people of color, Black people, and in particular Black men, speak honestly and openly about depression and mental health? And have you gotten feedback from people who are going through similar things?
Oh, man, that album would have me in tears to, like, revisit those times to write from that perspective, you know, coming off of the War album with Duck Down, shout out to Duck Down, Guy Routier, my manager, was like, you gotta really get back in there and try and put enough, you know, another project out. You take too long to do projects. And I was like, you know, it would just be dope to come back with this record, personal record right after this War record. You know, with the Still Standing, and really dig into it, not just use PTSD as for going through, but really dig into your emotional background, let people see more into who Troy Jameson is and was. So I knew I would have to, I wasn't experiencing depression at the time of writing the record, so I knew I would have to revisit those times, and it was difficult to do. You know, it's based in me being hospitalized with the asthma and being on so many medications and cocktails of different chemicals that it just threw me out of whack. And when I was released from the hospital, you know, things that I normally would be able to cope with, I was noticing that I wasn't able to process emotionally, and took me to a dark place. Found out about what I was going through randomly by going to a dentist appointment and writing down the medications that I was on a sheet of paper. And the dentist coming out into the lobby, inviting me back into his office space, sitting me down. I'm like, this is weird. Sitting me down at his desk and saying, do you realize that this particular cocktail of medications that you're on, this one in particular, causes severe depression? And I just wanted to speak to you and look at you and ask, you know, do you realize the side effects of the medications you're on? And I fell over and bawled on the desk. And I just, all of these weights were lifted from me just from getting an idea of knowing what was causing my depression. Wow. Because I didn't know. And so it just, as much as you are affected by the darkness and the weight, I was also like, why? And I don't understand why this happened all of a sudden. But for me, luckily, it was the medication, and I pulled out and adjusted and got myself back. Realizing that can happen to you, I realized that some people, it may not be that simple. And when I was going through it, you know, I would call people and be like, yo, I'm not feeling correct. You know, in my community, people be like, smoke a blunt, get a beer, suck it up, you know. And I was like, no. And, you know, a couple of real friends were like, yo, this is like, you need to get professional help if you're feeling this way. I can't talk you out of this. I can't talk you back to norm. If you're really feeling this way, you need to get professional help. And that was some years ago. It wasn't present time that I was writing the record. But it just made me feel like how many people may be off kilt and don't even express it. And it's been prevalent in all communities all this time, and something that we're just now becoming equipped and having the language to express and communicate what we're feeling and how to feel with it. I think we're becoming more comfortable. Like my parents and in the Black community, hard work. And I seen my father, like, you know, go to work sick at 5 a.m. in the morning every day. So you're not thinking if you have an issue that you can't see.
That's right.
To go to your parents and be like, you know, I'm not feeling, you know, it's like, what are you talking about? You know? So in that community, I think the part of the pressure comes from seeing Black parents and Black people grind through so much in our lifetimes, you don't want to talk about something that you can't physically see or to somebody. And it feels like it's a weakness. But I think absolutely we're becoming more adjusted to dealing with mental health as a primary issue.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing that. That's such an important point you made that I've never even thought about it on that level.
And that was an interview conducted by hip-hop artist Talib Kweli with hip-hop artist Pharoah Monch. And it's 7:18 and 52 degrees in Central Park. You're tuned to listener sponsor WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day.
Love's gonna get you killed, but pride's gonna be the death of you and you and me and you and you and you and me and you and you and you and me and you and you and you and you.
La la la. chasing new worldly possessions. Flesh making, spirit breaking, which one would you missing? The better part, the human heart, you love them or dissect them. Happiness or flashiness, how do you serve the question? See, in the perfect world, I would be perfect world. I don't trust people enough beyond their surface world. I don't love people enough to put my faith in man. I put my faith in these lyrics, hoping I make a band. I understand I ain't perfect, I probably won't come around. This time I might put you down, last time I ain't give up. I still feel the same now, my feelings might go numb. You're dealing with cold though. I'm willing to give up a leg and arm to show empathy from. Baby, parties and functions are you and yours. A perfect world, you probably live another 24. I can't fake humble just cause you're insecure. I can't fake humble just cause you're insecure.
And that was Pride by Kendrick Lamar, and the influence of Prince is clearly observable or audible in that introduction to this hip-hop tune. And it's 7:21 a.m., and last week we learned about the state of the U.S. economy, and that's the following, that on the one hand, the federal government is painting a rosy picture of growth, but long-standing problems persist. And these problems are only temporarily obscured by the money that the federal government has pumped into the economy with stimulus checks, but also the vaccine rollout. The underlying problems, however, persist, and these are some of them. Estimates of U.S. productive capacity point to a steady path of decline. Many workers have left the workforce for good, and many small to medium businesses will never return. The bottom 80% of American households continue to struggle to make ends meet. And today we continue our conversation with Michael Roberts on these issues and on the framework that constitutes Marxist economics. Michael Roberts worked in the City of London as an economist for over 40 years. He has closely observed the machinations of global capitalism from within the dragon's den. Since retiring, he has written several books, including The Great Recession, A Marxist View, The Long Depression, Marx 200, A Review of Marxist Economics, and jointly with Guglielmo Carcetti, he is editor of World in Crisis. Michael Roberts has published numerous papers in various economic journals and articles in leftist publications. He also writes regular commentary and analysis on his blog, The Michael Roberts Blog. Michael Roberts, welcome once again to A New Day.
Good morning, John.
Good morning. So, in a recent blog you posted, maybe 3 weeks ago, you reminded your reader of Marx's two major contributions to our understanding of history and capitalism. That's Karl Marx's two major contributions to our understanding of history and capitalism, and that's historical materialism and surplus value. Can you talk to us about each of these? What are they to listeners who might not be familiar with these concepts?
Well, the first one, which Marx called the materialist conception of history, he said, look, most people look at history and they look at in Europe anyway, kings and queens or presidents, what they do, what individuals do to change the world or to change situations or decisions that they make. And individuals' ideas and their decisions are what decides how history develops for the rest of us over time. And Marx said that's not really what happens. What much more important and much more fundamental is the economic and social structure of a society and how that changes. And within that, the various forces, what he refers to as class forces, which bring about changes in the economic structure. It could be technology. It could be a change of, say, for the owners of land giving way to the owners of industry. It could be certain struggles over wages and conditions. These bring about big changes in the in history and in human organization, rather than what individuals do. Well, that has an effect, but overall, it's you have to look at the fundamental economic and social structure, the materialist basis of any society. So he wanted to emphasize that that's how you should understand history. History develops on the basis of what's going on in the economic and social structure, and not just on whether one president makes a decision here or not. And we should start from that point of view, and we understand better what's happening in the world as a result. And as you say, Joanna, he had another important discovery. He thought that in the current social structure we have, which is what he would call the capitalist mode of production, the basic mode of production and investment in modern economies called capitalism is that you only produce and you only invest for profit. And therefore, the drive is to find profit, what Marx called surplus value, the surplus over and above what owners and employers pay workers to go to work and produce things and services for them. And that surplus value is what the capitalists are after. So we have a mode of production which is not aimed at people's needs or what the general society might see as necessary, but purely on what the owners of capital, the owners of the big businesses, land, finance, and so on, is profitable for them. So those are his two main discoveries about the nature of human society. It's materialist development, it's economic development, and in the current capitalist society, a drive for production based on profit and nothing else.
So just to reiterate, especially on the concept of surplus value, that surplus value is the value that remains after costs are paid, in particular workers' wages. And out of that surplus value is what capitalists see as profit, so that profits come from literally the unpaid labor of workers. Is that correct?
Yes, that's how Marx sees it. He said, think of a working day. Say you go to work for 8 hours in a day, for 5 days or whatever. He says, well, the value involved in producing enough goods for you and your family to live on, whatever it might be, the things you buy in the shops, the things you need to keep utilities going, your transport, all those costs that enable you to go back the next day and go to work again and survive. He said, on average, that's out of an 8-hour day, probably the amount of value produced in the goods that or services you're producing for the owners will be about 4 hours. But then you carry on working for another 4 hours, and it's that 4 hours embodied in the products that you produce, which the owners and the employers then sell on the market, whether it's services or physical goods. That extra 4 hours is unpaid. You don't get it, but embodied in the sales that the capitalist makes, he gets that extra profit. And in fact, he wouldn't make any production. He wouldn't employ you unless he could make that profit, because the aim of production for profit is the essential nature of this process.
And so where does the concept of overaccumulation fit in? And what is overaccumulation?
Well, it's a little bit more complex question for listeners to think about. But Marx said, well, Okay, so capitalists only produce for profit. They only employ you if they can make a profit. So that's the end of it. So at the end of the process, they sell some goods, they make a profit, you get a wages. So this, the system works, even if it might be unfair, as it's only based on profit and you don't get the full value of what you've produced, or society doesn't. But it works. Well, Marx said, no, it doesn't work, because the problem is, although because the system works for production for profit, actually, there's a big contradiction in the process, because actually profitability for the capitalist can tend to fall over time. Why is that? Because he said that only profit only comes from you guys going to work. Guys and gals go to work. If they don't go to work, nothing's produced, so there's no profit for the capitalists. So all the value that's produced in the goods that we are sold on the market, or the services that we pay for, all the value that's produced in those comes from us working, not from what the capitalist does. He just stumps up some money and makes you some work. Where he got the money from was from previous profits. So the value only comes from workers working. Now, if capitalists try to compete with each other to get bigger profits, which is what they do, then they intend to employ machinery and technology and replace workers with this new technology. Of course, and right now we're talking about automation, robots, and so on. So there's a reduction in the amount of workers' time going in to producing things relative to the investment that the capitalists are making. So here's the overaccumulation. There's too much investment from the point of view of profit in machinery and automation and so on relative to the amount of workers being employed, and only workers produce profit. So there's a tendency for profitability to fall. Well, you could say, well, don't buy the machines if it's going to be too costly relative to profit. Yet capitalists have to do that. They have to compete with each other. They're competing against each other. If they don't do that, the other capitalists with the better technology and so on will be able to undercut the more inefficient capitalist and take a bigger share of the market. So they're driven towards investing more and more in technology and reducing the labor force relatively. And as a result, there's a tendency for profitability to fall. I know that's a complex thing for listeners to understand, but it's a key discovery or law that Marx makes. So capitalism is production for profit, but the contradiction is that there's a tendency for that profitability relative to what the capitalists are investing to fall over time. So there's a risk of regular crises where capitalists say, oh, we haven't got enough profit. We're going to stop investing, we're going to stop employing. And then we get slumps. And that's what we see. We see slumps and recessions on an 8 to 10 year basis in most capitalist economies, particularly over the last century.
So on this concept of the tendency of profit, of the rate of profit to fall, we can see that in the United States, the rate of profit in the 1950s was pretty high, and I don't know the statistics, but beginning in the 1970s, we see a steady decline in the rate of profit in the United States. Is there a connection between the rate of profit and what bourgeois economists call growth?
Yes, I think there is. This is one of my specialities and expertise, listeners, trying to measure the rate of profit, because I think it's so important. We've looked at the United States in particular because they have the best data. And also, of course, it's the most important capitalist economy in the world. And as you say, Johanna, after the end of the Second World War, the rate of profit was very high because there'd been a destruction of industry in Europe and elsewhere, but also devaluation of old machinery, and workers were relatively coming back to work. So there was a big boost in profitability in the 50s and 60s. We call that the golden age, when there was full employment, profitability was high, people's wages rose quite sharply. But then this law that I was talking about began to operate. And as you say, through the 1970s, right into the early 1980s, there was a very sharp drop in the profitability, not just in the US, but elsewhere in the major economies. And as a result, that produced a big, many struggles as people, workers trying to defend their wages and conditions, while the capitalists tried to reduce them because they wanted to avoid this decline in profitability. And then we had we got a slowdown in growth. And in fact, we had some serious slumps in 1980-82, a very bad slump, which decimated manufacturing around the world, the US, the UK, dramatically reduced, creating the conditions actually for a boost in profitability by a higher unemployment, destruction of old industries and, you know, in the smokestack areas of Middle West in the US and so on, creating the conditions for capitalists to boost profitability a bit. But they couldn't maintain that profitability rise for long. And we've had slowing growth, more slumps, slowing growth, more slumps. And now I like to call the current period we're in a long depression where profitability is relatively low. I'm not, when you think about it, you say, well, it can't be low. What about Amazon? What about Netflix? What about Facebook? They're making huge profits. Yes, but they're a very, very small minority of companies. The vast majority of US companies are struggling with their profitability, as the economic statistics show. So profitability is low. Investment isn't growing very much, even before COVID happened, and it won't afterwards. So, and growth is low. The Congressional Budget Office reckons once we get over this bounce back in 2021 and maybe 2022, growth rates are going to be about, in the US, about 1.7% in real terms in the growth of national output each year, which is about half where it was in the 1990s. That shows how capitalism is stagnating because of the difficulty it's got in producing for a profit.
You're listening to the voice of Michael Roberts. Michael Roberts is a British Marxist economist and author of several books, including World in Crisis, a global analysis of Marx's law of profitability. And we're talking about Marxist economics and how Marx understands the world of capitalism and profit. And I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day. You're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. And we're going to take callers later on in the show. The number to call is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. And I want to call attention to a caller we had last week when you were on from Connecticut who said that the stimulus packets or the stimulus checks we're getting, which I called popcorn, I just meant that, you know, they're just giving money out. And the point of that was to contrast the outlay of money now to arguments that capitalists and their politicians made just 2 years ago, that we can't afford this and we can't afford that, so everyone should eat cake. That was really my point. But the caller said that the surplus checks is essentially money owed to us that hasn't been given to us. The assumption is in wages. So can you comment on that? Because I think there's some truth there if we think about surplus value and the wages that are robbed from workers.
Well, yes. I mean, that's an interesting way and probably accurate way of thinking about it, because obviously these paychecks, we've had kind of two lots in America now, are the result of the huge slump in production and employment, people being sent home, forced to go work part-time, stay at home and so on, often without any other wage support, many small companies closing down, not being able to maintain their employment and wages for their staff. So the government has had to intervene, otherwise it would have been a catastrophic meltdown with unemployment and wage levels driven down to the levels of the Great Depression of the 1930s. So governments intervene, not just in the US, but elsewhere, to provide some wage support to people to millions of people in this position. And that was necessary. After all, what do we organize society for? What do we pay our taxes for? Unless when we have a crisis like this, particularly if employers are going to close down a way of making a living, that we don't use government to give us that support. So I think the listener from Connecticut is right in a sense. This is only this is socially necessary. And that's the important thing we have to understand, that it seems to me that we have to help society. Action has to be taken for social need, not for private profit. Now, later on, of course, down the road, we may see that the employers and the capitalists will say, well, that's enough. We now need to restore the position of our operations and business, and we don't want to employ quite as many people as before. We don't want to pay them the same wages or give them the same conditions. We're going to try and get back some of that money going down the road. So workers will have to pay for much of this disaster that we've had over the last 15, 16 months.
And you're listening to the voice of Michael Roberts, who's a British Marxist economist and author of several books. And we're talking about the economy, the Marxist understanding of how capitalism works. And I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day, and this is WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. And the number to call if you have questions or comments is 212-209-2877. Once again, that's 212-209-2877. Can you talk to us about the advent of AI and the implications of AI, artificial intelligence, for the economy?
Well, it's a big subject, Joanna, and there are a lot of conflicting views about whether artificial intelligence, robots, artificial intelligence, machine learning. So machines learning, like we learn how to do things, and they learn more and more, and we don't need to instruct them. They automatically or gradually build up their own learning process and their knowledge to even surpass what we might do in particular tasks. So the AI is an exciting idea that it will actually, if you think about it in general, it would mean a great boon to humanity, that we can get rid of a lot of boring, drudgery tasks. We can do even more complicated things with artificial intelligence, so it enables life to be much easier, for us to spend less time working to make a living, because machines and artificial machine learning machines can take over and do many of these jobs and reduce the hours that we have to work. But, of course, the history of introduction of technology, not just AI or robots, but in previous histories of development of technology and introduction of machinery and mechanization, has often meant a sharp drop in the available jobs for working people, because how those machines and technologies apply depends on whether the owners of the machines and technology, the private owners of the machines and technology, want to employ the same number of people as a result, or reduce their hours. The usual solution has been to get rid of a load of workers, not reduce the hours of workers, because if you look at the annual hours that American workers have now compared to where they were, say, 40 years ago, there's hardly any difference. So there's no improvement in the amount of working hours we have in the year. Our holidays haven't been increased. Our working week hasn't been reduced. Our working day hasn't been reduced on the whole. In fact, often the opposite. And yet we have more machinery, which threatens the jobs of the future. And the current AI position is, there's a different views, that it will mean 40% of current occupations will disappear as robots and AI are introduced over the next couple of decades. I would temper that very disastrous view with two things. First of all, AI has got a long way to go. It can't change do a lot of tasks that humans can do, particularly agility and dexterity and dealing with other humans. It's not in that position to do that to the moment. But also, if there is an expansion of industry as a result of the new technology into new sectors, there will be new jobs as well. So the Marxists don't say, oh, that's the robots and AI and technology is a disaster, all jobs will go. No, it's a balance between the new jobs and old jobs. But the decisions are not made by us. They're made by the owners of industry and capital. And that's the real problem. If it was done by society as a whole democratically, we could use those extra technology and new resources to help us reduce our hours and improve our living conditions and not leave some people out of work and other people at the behest of machines.
We've got a number of callers. We're going to take those now. Caller, your name and where you're calling from.
Good morning. My name is Denise. I'm calling from Brooklyn. Thank you so much for the program. Excuse me. You know, I was thinking about the profit, desire for profit within the power structure. But, you know, I see it more like the profit stems from the rate of greed. And the profit drops because the power structure's greed becomes grows more. It seems more like that. And I'm trying to figure out how we, the average person, can turn this thing around. And I will say that one of the things is WBAI and media that covers the truth. Like this gentleman is speaking, he's opening up a dialogue about it for us to think how we can move forward. So, you know, we've got to save WBAI, and we have to bring more members in. But I really think it's stemming from it's greed that makes profit drop. We're going to have to figure out how we're going to, we, the average person, can turn this around. I'm just baffled. I'm going to give you back the line. Thanks so much.
Thank you so very much, Denise, for calling. Michael, I'm going to take two callers, but this is a really important question. Is it the rate of greed that is leading to crises and the loss of profitability? I'm going to take a few more callers. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, it's Russell in White Plains.
Welcome.
What we don't need on BAI are more callers making advertisements, okay? And to me, handouts are more characteristic of oligarchy. Returning surplus value in a structural sense is not a handout. And I'd like to ask Mike, since disruptions are how capitalisms renew their opportunities to make money, and he's familiar with Friedrich Engels' false consciousness, Mike, do you think the ruling class, in order to get workers to do things against their own interests, have confabulated this whole epidemic? Thanks, Mike.
So is the epidemic a confabulation of the ruling class to create profitability? We're going to take another caller. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hello?
Yes, you're on
the line.
You are.
Yeah, my name's Eric. I'm calling from Williamsburg. I hate to challenge the person, but I believe he's almost creating an invisible hand and going back to Adam Smith. You know, the first volume of Kapital was just republished from the notes of Karl Marx's wife, and it's a completely different book. Haymarket published it. He never mentions the fact that most labor today, most work, including you, Joanna, although you're a wonderful person, is work of social control and not work of production of products. And I wish I had the time to challenge him to a debate, because I think he really misunderstands Marx greatly. I'm sorry to object, but I have to.
So most people who are employed are in the labor of social control?
Yeah, correct. Even your job is at teaching in a university. Most teachers are training people to accept the false consciousness. Most policemen are involved in social control. Most government workers are involved in social control.
Copy.
Very few people are in the direct production of products anymore.
Copy. Do we have other callers? Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hello?
Caller.
This is Brother Davis in Brooklyn. What's on my mind is I'm just wondering, with the situation we now have where in the United States people are getting poorer and poorer, maybe half the people are poor or near poor, in the U.S. The idea of having capitalism and democracy, I mean, is that really possible? Can the people be in a state where it's claimed that we have democracy and capitalism at the same time? Isn't that like oil and water?
Brother Davis, thank you so very much. Michael, you've got some questions here.
Yeah.
I hope you've taken notes.
I have tried, yes. Denise says that greed is the big thing behind things. It reminds me, I don't know if you remember, Gordon Gekko saying that greed is good. I think that was in a movie, wasn't it? Or was it probably a real thing as well? We recently, our own Prime Minister in the UK said the reason we've had successful vaccination rollout is because of greed. So it appears that the leaders of our countries and the owners of capital quite like greed. And you could argue correctly that the drive for production and investment is based on greed or profit, if you like. We need more profit before we'll invest more and we'll produce more. I think Denise is saying, though, but this is a disaster down the road. Greed will lead to a collapse. And there's a certain truth in what she says, because we remember the financial crash of 2008 when all these big banks were trying to suck up as much profit as they could get out of people's mortgages that were being bought and sold, people taking out dangerous mortgages, and these being bought and sold by the banks to try and make extra profit, a completely fictitious form of profit, not real, based on anything that's being produced. And that greed, that drive, led to a terrible collapse, which damaged not only the American economy, but the world economy as well. So there's a certain truth in what Denise says. I don't agree with Russell, though, that the COVID pandemic was a plot by governments of the world to control people and to reduce their living standards and so on. I think the governments of the world were just totally unprepared to deal with this new pathogen that spread across the world and infected people and killed, as we know, getting on for 2 to 3 million people already, even worse than anything flu could do. And also disrupted the health systems of the world, but put us in a terrible position. They were totally unprepared. They hadn't got the resources in the health systems. They'd cut them back so much. They were just not able to deal with this. And thank God that we have scientists in universities and the public sector around the world to come up with vaccines so quickly that we could develop to hopefully reduce and mitigate this disease. But what Russell is right about is that they will use this COVID slump pandemic to try and change the wages and conditions of workers as we come out of it, and also to increase their monitoring control of what goes on in society. We have a very nasty police bill in the UK that's being introduced, which is going to reduce the ability of people to protest about anything as a result. And they all say it's all because we need that to control the COVID. So there's a lot of a follow-up that may well come from that. The argument about unproductive social control, which we're referring to, so many people work in areas of social control. Well, the true way of putting it, I think, and the accurate way of putting it, is there's a large numbers of workers which Marxist economics would say would unproductive. They're unproductive for the capitalists. The capitalists want, as the caller said, they want productive workers who are producing things and services which they can sell at a profit. They're not really interested in having workers working in teaching, in the health service, in providing public services and all the other things that government does, but because that's actually a cost to them in taxation and doesn't actually produce any value. And yet, modern capitalist societies need more and more of these people to keep things going, because the productive capitalist sector is not so productive as it was. But there is also social control, I would say to this caller, not just from government workers, who are necessary in my view. Health workers are necessary. Teachers are necessary. We don't want to cut back on that. They are productive for capitalists, but not for society. But there are some unproductive workers who are also unproductive for society. All the people who do advertising, marketing, all kinds of supervisory control of what happens at work, checking on us all the time, all this sort of thing that goes on in work and in marketing and so on, is a massive waste of our resources and putting people into jobs that really aren't necessary. We could certainly do without those, which is why, in many ways, as Davis says, that we have a situation where inequality has grown dramatically in the United States. Poverty hasn't really fallen. People will be shocked to hear what the average wage is, the average wage for a worker going to work full time in the US. It's way, way lower than people think. They often do surveys to say, how much do you think the average wage is of a full time worker? People are usually two or three times higher than reality. There are millions, tens of millions of Americans who go to work every day full time, who are hardly earning enough to keep their families going. They've got no spare savings. If anything goes wrong on health or bills of that sort, then they're hit into debt. So this situation has continued for decades, if not longer, and doesn't have any signs of changing. Now, I call that undemocratic. I agree with Davis. How can we talk about democracy under capitalism? We get a vote once every 4 years or once every 2 years to change the same people who continue with whatever we had before, but nothing is done about social democracy, improving the conditions and ending the inequalities and raising people's living standards to something which makes life worthwhile.
You've been listening to the voice of Michael Roberts. Michael Roberts is a British Marxist economist and author of several books, including The Long Depression, The Great Recession, A Marxist View, The Long Depression, and Marx 200, A Review of Marxist Economics. He also writes regular commentary and analysis on his blog, The Michael Roberts Blog. Michael Roberts, you have offered an illuminating framework for understanding where we are in the economy. Thank you so very much for joining us, and we hope you will come back.
Thank you, Joanna, for having me, and thank you, the callers, for very good questions.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
You've been listening to non-commercial, listener-funded community radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York, and now is really the time to become a member of WBAI. We need you to become a member by April 7th. And the number to call, if you'd like to do that, is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. We need you to vote on April 7th, and to do that, you have to become a member of the station. We're rebuilding the world together here at WBAI, and that's why we want you to join us and ushering in a new day. This show is produced by Ajamu Sankofa, Ellis Maxwell, and Marcos Maldonado Cruz. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. We leave you with Masterpiece by Big Thief. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day. See you tomorrow.
And you're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org on the web. We have just a few minutes before the top of the hour, before we get to Democracy Now! That comes your way at 8 o'clock. And as Johanna said, we need you to become members. We need you to